Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Bittler. Mr. Emhart.
May it please the Court, I would like to begin by focusing on three primary points that help to demonstrate the error of the District Court in rendering summary judgment against the plaintiffs. First, paragraph 2 of the Master Amendment is not merely an indemnity agreement.
I found your briefs very confusing, so it would help me if you would make clear to us what exactly is an issue here. Now, we start off with 14 of these gas stations. Now, how many are at issue in this appeal?
Yes, Your Honor, there are 8 properties at issue in this appeal. 6 of the properties were eliminated from the litigation and other summary judgment rulings involving the meaning of release documents and lease termination documents that were signed at six of the properties. Those are not at issue in the appeal. What went to trial were what were called non-environmental waste claims on 6 properties. And so those...
Well, now, wait a second. First you said 6 are not at issue, and now you're saying six are at issue?
Well, 6 of the 14 were eliminated or not on appeal. That leaves 8. And of those 8, 6 were the subject of a trial in the district court last November. 2 were not.
So what's left of the 6? Are they still? Is this the double damage? Are they here on double damages, or are they not here at all?
With respect to the properties located in Michigan, the double damage Michigan statute we seek to apply in the case, and the district court's ruling.
Which ones are those?
Oh no. Those are the Adrian, Michigan property, Battle Creek, Owosso, Sturgis, Portland, and Coldwater. And the Indiana properties are Angola and North Manchester.
Now wait, so there are 6 that are here on the question of double damages for waste? Is that what you're saying?
Correct, Your Honor.
And they are what again?
Adrian, Battle Creek, Coldwater, Owosso, Portland, and Sturgis.
All right, so those 6 are just on double damages.
Well, Your Honor.
The challenge here is we've got several different argued errors that are going to apply differently to the 8 different sites because of different blends of whether sites are remediated, remediation was done or not, whether the district judge allowed damages for waste, because there were 2 that she didn't, right?
Correct.
And we can, if we try to sort things through property by property, we're going to wind up even more confused. If we focus on the specific legal issues, we can sort out how they apply to the different properties. So what are the 3 points that you
the
make?
First was
those 6 you named, are those the ones that we're concerned about whether you're entitled to double damages for waste?
That's one of the issues for those 6 properties, and they're the properties located in Michigan. And there are 2 properties located in Indiana that would not benefit from that statute.
Okay, so those are 6 cases involved in the appeal. Are there 6 properties? Are there other properties involved in the appeal?
2 more properties.
What are they?
Angola, Indiana, and North Manchester, Indiana.
What's the issue for them?
Well, the issue for all 8 of the properties is that for all 8, the breach of contract claims were thrown out, and for all 8, essentially, the waste claims were thrown out or with the ruling changed in such a way that the plaintiffs were not allowed to present.
What's the difference between the first 6 you mentioned and the next 2?
Well, just their location, Michigan and Indiana.
statute applies to the Michigan properties for double damages, in your view. Indiana, you just get single damages, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, on the waste claims.
That's the only difference, that Angola and North Manchester, Indiana?
With respect to the waste claims that are in the case. To us, the heart of the case was a breach of contract case, though. And the parties
had... And that applies to all.
And that applies to all of them. And the parties all... They entered into leases for all eight properties that were identical in form. And then in 1992, for all eight properties, entered into master amendments, which were to deal with the removal of the underground storage tanks from the property and remediation if that was required. Paragraph 2 of the master...
So your argument is that they have not sufficiently restored these properties? Is that true?
That's one of the arguments, yes, if you would look at the... improvements.
One of the arguments. What are the other arguments?
The other arguments is that our clients have sustained large losses in not being able to use the properties for sometimes up to 20 and more years as they're being remediated, and that they have a loss of use along with a destruction or a waste of all the improvements at all the eight sites. And we, in the lower court, we had a number of experts that were giving opinions as to damages to my clients, and none of those expert opinions were examined by the district court, Albert. But it is a – we look to
– What would be a typical example of a failure of restoring the properties or
– Okay. To take Battle Creek. Battle Creek is a property that was closed, and the tanks were pulled in 1994. The Marathon left the property. There was an incredible amount of overgrowth of weeds. The building didn't fall down, but there was mold damage. The cost to fix the building is substantial. A canopy over the underground storage tanks and the pumps was removed.
You want the canopy back?
For that site, we do, yes.
Mm-hmm. But does that mean you're going to operate it as a gas station?
We could. I think what we want is the benefit of the terms of the lease and the master agreement.
To operate it as a gas station.
My clients had not made a decision with respect.
Is it possible?
They would have to.
Been removed. It's all cemented over. How are you going to run it as a gas station?
Well, again, they'd have to bring in another company, or themselves bring in new underground storage tanks and pumps.
They're
not
going to do that.
Well,
does the canopy have any value other than as part of a gas station?
Some of the other properties that aren't part of the appeal.
No, I'm talking about Battle Creek.
Okay, at Battle Creek, the canopy had a value to the plaintiffs.
As a gas station, my question is, does it have any value for any other use of the property?
And we did bring in a witness, a used car owner who actually leased a number of these locations from the plaintiffs, and the canopies were useful in that business to help sell cars, if it was going to be used as a used car lot to be able to work outside, out of the elements, under a canopy was a benefit to the property. And
will any of these properties be used as gas stations?
I think that that there's a possibility of that, and that our clients they're
not used as gas stations. What are they used? Well, you mentioned a used car lot.
Yes, the Hillsdale, Michigan, was used as a haircut place, I believe. Marathon itself took the Angola location and used it as a tobacco store. So there are other uses. We believe that these properties are situated in good locations for being gas stations, and that there is a market in this country for a station that isn't a great big convenience store like Marathon likes to do, but there are you know, scattered throughout the Midwest, gas stations that operate on properties like this.
Mr. Emhart, suppose we agree with you that Marathon had an obligation to maintain the improvements and to leave them in good condition at the end of the lease term. As to the six properties that were tried on the waste claims, what more damages could you possibly be entitled to?
We believe on those claims that focused just on building improvements, and that there were delay damages, the inability to use the properties for an extended period of time, that also would be at issue if this judgment were reversed.
Okay, the delay damages. Now, there was some mention in the briefing of stigma, but I would have thought that would have already been captured in your evidence based on appraisals.
Actually, the appraisal evidence really didn't capture the stigma part of the case, but our expert
on if you're looking at fair market value before and after, why wouldn't that be the case?
Well, we weren't able to appraise the properties until a significant amount of time after the waste had been started to be committed. So when we got to the properties, we're doing appraisals in 2006 of properties that we've been complaining about since 2000.
But compared to what? I mean, you've got to be comparing as is to some alternate hypothetical. And that alternate hypothetical presumably would have been without any stigma that might have been attached, right?
True, but also the condition of the improvements is deteriorating over time, and an appraiser's looking at the conditions of the improvements as of a date that if they had been maintained, would have a greater value.
Well, I guess I'm still having trouble understanding how your appraisal evidence would not capture any theory of stigma.
Mm-hmm. Well, the appraisals were just property appraisals done with the looking at what the building looked like at that moment in time. And to take North Manchester as an example, North Manchester had the ceiling had caved in, and there was mold damage throughout the whole property. So the appraiser's going in and looking at a property that's already lost, improvements have already lost value.
Right. Yeah. I understand that. Okay. But I don't – well, look, in these environmental cases, there's this aura, the stigma. Right?
Yes.
And ordinarily, that's proven with appraisals, right? Compare fair market value as is with whatever stigma is there as compared to what might have been if the defendant had behaved differently, right?
That's correct. And
so what's missing?
Well, we didn't present experts on what is the harm from not being able to use an environmentally impaired property. We had experts available to do that, but the summary judgment on the breach of contract, leaving only a waste claim, eliminated anything but looking at the condition of the buildings. So,
okay. If I could ask you one other question at least. I guess I'm very confused here by the relationship between the breach of contract and waste claims. If one accepts the district judge's analysis of this case, I understand that it makes a difference. But I really have trouble understanding the difference between the two types of claims here.
The heart of the breach of contract is in paragraph 2 of the Master Amendment, where as a result of Marathon agreeing to do the remediation, remove the underground storage tanks, that they were going to be responsible for any and all losses resulting from the use of the premises. And so those losses, whatever those are the breach of contract.
Okay. Let me press you a little bit about we've been asking you a lot of questions, but let me press you about paragraph 2 and, in essence, why you are relying so heavily on paragraph 2 with its rather – I mean, I understand that first sentence is pretty broad, and I'll want to ask defense counsel what they think that sentence means. But You've also got provisions in the master amendment saying that the premises will be left in a condition reasonably useful for future commercial use, that asphalt, concrete, et cetera, will be restored. And then in paragraph 4, lessee shall return the premises to lessor as nearly as possible in the same condition as it was in prior to such remediation work, subject only to removal of contamination, normal wear from reasonable use. Those all sound like pretty explicit assurances that the leasehold premises will be returned in good shape. Why aren't those provisions enough to get you at least most of what it is you're looking for?
We believe that those provisions do all say that, and that there were multiple breaches of the lease and the master amendment in the way that Marathon acted and did not act with respect to these properties, and that there is a remedy for that in paragraph 2. Then the district court, though, found that all Marathon had to do was pay rent, and as long as they were paying rent and cleaning up the properties.
Doesn't that displace waste? That is, if parties to a lease, if they agree very specifically as to what the lessee's duty is, what room is there for a waste claim?
I think that that waste is an independent. I think that a person.
You're gonna turn every lease into a waste case, every lease dispute into a waste case.
I think that the common law puts a requirement on any tenant and property to treat it in a reasonable
yes.
way.
If there's no contract specifying the lessee's responsibilities, but if you have a contract with detailed provisions that Judge Hamilton read, what room is there left for waste?
The contract certainly covers a lot of things.
Everything. So what's left for waste?
In our, the thrust of our case and why we're appealing is that we've lost all of our breach of contract claims by the district court's ruling. But
well, that's a terrible argument.
We can fix that.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Look, if you have a breach of contract claim and it covers everything that would, waste is a residual remedy if the parties haven't said anything about possible damage to the property.
I would agree with you that the contract can cover the waterfront of waste claims, and that a lot of landlords try to do that with the leases that they write. Yes.
How much are you seeking?
We had a damages expert that with the 8 claims was seeking, I would say, in the neighborhood of $8 million when everything was said and done. The property appraisals and an unemployment.
That's for breach of contract. That's not for the waste.
Correct.
So what's basically you want to double that.
The waste statute does allow for double damages.
But that's not for everything. The waste would be the damage to the property, not the delay damages, not your.
Correct. The waste
like
is for the harm to the real estate.
What was if everything had been left the way you guys wanted it to be left, what would the total fair market value of those properties be?
Our appraisers in 2006 were appraising the properties. It's been a long time, but in the $2 million range or so.
So how do we get to $8 million in damages for property that's only worth $2 million under your theory?
It's that the properties are rendered valueless and unable to be utilized in any way for an extended period of time.
But they could have, if they had just taken over the properties completely, wouldn't that be? If they just said we're hanging on to them, sue us, your damages would have been that fair market value, right?
We would have here we had a contract, and I think that it's the extended period of time of waiting that makes the damages what they are. I would say that we never got to any criticism of our damage theory in the district court, And, you know, a motion in limines were filed on all the experts, or on two out of three anyway, and those were deferred until later. And I would say that our expert is a certified business valuation person with very good credentials on his calculation of the damages. But
for four times fair market value? I understand you didn't get there. A couple of quick questions to sort of clean up here, Mr. Emhardt. Out of those eight properties that are still in dispute, four of them at the time of trial, as I understand it, had not yet had closure from the environmental agencies. Is that right?
That's correct.
Have they been closed for administrative purposes by now?
I believe that there's, at this point in time, that only the Michigan Center property is open with the Michigan
with the
Department
agency. At the time of trial, was Marathon still paying rent on any of those eight properties?
Yes, Marathon was paying rent on on Battle Creek. I think there were two, but they were paying rent, and we had a stipulation to that effect for trial.
And are they still paying rent on those?
My understanding is that they stopped paying rent after trial.
Okay.
Now, what if you have a property where what they did was they removed the canopy, they removed the underground storage tanks, and they cemented over the ground above the storage tanks? Would you have any problem with that?
With some of these properties, if they were able to be remediated quickly, tanks pulled and turned over to us, we signed lease termination documents, and if it could have been done quickly without a delay, then there wouldn't be damage.
How does one gauge what is a proper delay?
I guess in this case, I think that both sides to this transaction agreed that it was taking too long a time. And Mr. Gilbert was a representative of Marathon, who was paying money to fix up some of the properties, and who wrote a letter saying, please let us delay repaving obligations and building restoration obligations until we're done with remediation or a tenant's found. Rest assured, Marathon National Petroleum fulfills its obligations. And when he wrote that letter and had other conversations with Maxine Melching, he was showing that both sides understood that what was happening was taking too long a time.
Well, don't you also have evidence that in several of the properties, the relevant environmental agency cited Marathon for delay in remediation?
Yeah, at two of the properties, North Manchester and Angola, under the jurisdiction of IDEM, NOVs were issued for not following
NOV
through.
NOV is a notice of violation.
No notice of violations were
issued. Okay,
were
and then in some of the other locations, if my notes are correct, you had, you know, it was, 20 years at Battle Creek, right?
Right.
Since the time the tanks were pulled.
Right.
Or 18 years at Michigan Center and so on.
Right, and at Battle Creek, soil excavation didn't even happen until more than 10 years after the tanks have been pulled. But I guess the other way...
Your view is that you don't need an expert witness to say that if nothing's happening, that's unreasonable?
Yes, and I also think that Paragraph 2 of the Master Amendment doesn't impose a fault requirement on the plaintiffs to show that something's taking too long, and that that was understood. And I think when the buildings, the cities condemned the buildings, that things have gone on, lack of care has gone on for too long of a time there, and that laws are being violated, that are all things that are set to be recovered under the leases and the master amendments.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Emhardt. Mr. Craig?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The district court correctly entered summary judgment on the breach of contract claim brought by Bittler because nothing in the lease agreements or the master amendment required Marathon to repair, restore, or rebuild the improvements on the property. Rather, paragraph 2, which plaintiff relies upon in this case, is an indemnity clause requiring Marathon to indemnify Bittler Investment for...
Craig, in terms of the duty of improvements, can you talk about these provisions in the master amendment that I was referring to in paragraphs 1 and 4?
Yes, Your Honor. In paragraph 1, I believe the language is, the lessee shall leave the premises in a condition reasonably useful for future commercial use. And our understanding of that provision is that the properties would be remediated, so there would be environmental remediation, the underground storage tanks would be removed, and therefore Bittler and Melching would be able to market these properties for other useful purposes other than as gas
station. That's an interesting understanding, and I tend to agree that these weren't going to be terribly useful for gas stations, probably. But that's driven by the economics of the market. But I'm really troubled here by the idea, okay, condition reasonably useful for future commercial use. I don't see how that excludes improvements. And then when we get to paragraph 4, return premises to lessor as nearly as possible in the same condition as it was in prior to such remediation work. Presumably that includes the improvements as well, right?
We don't believe so, Your Honor.
How do you get out of the buildings there?
The buildings are a part of the property, but they are, as it recognizes, subject to normal wear from reasonable use. And reasonable use has to be looked at in terms of what happened with the master amendment. When the master amendment was entered into, the parties agree that the underground storage tanks would be removed and there may be other activities necessary to complete the remediation. And therefore, that was going to radically change the character of the properties.
So that sounds like what you're saying is implicit in those provisions is an ability to totally neglect the buildings as long as the remediation takes up to 20 years in one case. The
provisions do not impose any specific obligations on Marathon with respect to maintenance or repair obligations.
No, they impose duties about the condition the property will be in at the end of the leasehold.
Correct, Your Honor. And with taking a look at one of the cases that was discussed at length in the briefing, the Yasma versus Shell Oil Company, the Third Circuit, in interpreting a provision that actually required restoration to the original state, indicated that in its holding, the meaning of that was that the lessee had to get a no further action letter from the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection so that it could be marketed. And that's what we did and are doing in these properties.
That doesn't answer my questions about the improvements, though. Let me ask about this from a different angle. Let's look at the original leases, okay? If I understand the district judge's reasoning correctly, she found no express provision requiring the tenant to take care of the improvements on the property, right?
That's correct.
And that's why that's one of the reasons she granted summary judgment for you all. Now, suppose there's no master amendment here. Would it be your theory that you could have allowed done no repair, no upkeep, and simply turned the buildings, or maybe even bulldozed them the day before the leasehold ends, and there's no damage, no breach of the contract?
I don't know that it would involve that we would be authorized to remove any of the improvements.
So you're not, because you'd have to have consent, or you'd have to replace with greater or equal value, right?
We would need consent, and the greater equal value involves a situation where we voluntarily undertake some restoration or improvement of the building.
Exactly. But I'm trying to think of how we could agree with the district judge's reasoning here without saying tenants in commercial leases, and maybe all kinds of leases, have no obligation to take care of the property at all. I would think that if we're looking to construe contracts, we would normally expect tenants to be required to take reasonable care of premises that they occupy to the exclusion of the landlord. And if somebody wants to get out of that obligation, you would need some explicit contracting around that obligation. I would think that very few landlords would assume that when they're leasing their property, the tenant has no obligation to take care of it.
Well, Your Honor, I think there are two ways to get out of that result. One, of course, is landlords can protect themselves through specific contract provisions. The second is, unless there is a contract provision specifically allowing destruction or waste of the property, the landlord, as the landlords in this case did, could pursue an action for waste. And so Bentler has not been without a remedy in this case.
You think the remedy here is waste?
We have not appealed the damages for waste in this case.
What about the provision that says the lessee shall return the premises to lessor as nearly as possible in the same condition as it was in prior to remediation? It does impose some obligation on Marathon, doesn't it?
It imposes a duty to remediate the property. It imposes a duty, I believe, not to intentionally destroy the property.
No,
where do you get
that?
That's
not what it
limit?
Says. There's nothing about intention. It says, lessee shall return the premises to lessor as nearly as possible in the same condition as it was in prior to such remediation, subject only to the removal of the contamination and normal wear from reasonable use of the property. So why isn't that pretty unequivocal?
I would agree it's unequivocal, but I would not agree that it imposes specific maintenance obligations. The obligations are removal of underground.
If you have to return it in the same condition, that certainly does imply a maintenance obligation. Otherwise, it won't be in the same condition.
But it's not the same condition. It's the same condition subject to the removal of the contamination and normal wear from use of the property. So for several years, these properties underwent a process of environment.
Isn't that a trial issue, whether this was normal wear or excessive wear or failure to return the premises? The duty to return implies that often the lessee will be required to do something, not just sit there. Why isn't that a triable issue?
It's not a triable issue because the only damages sought in this case are for the improvements which were subject to the remediation process. That there's no question that Marathon did a lot on these properties during the time of its occupation. There was extensive environmental remediation.
What force do you give to the word shall return the premises as nearly as possible in the same condition? Doesn't that imply some activity on the part of the lessee?
The activity, I believe, is expressly set forth in the master amendment, which is the removal of the underground storage tanks and the remediation of the property. There's, you know, to the extent consistent with those activities, the properties can be returned to Bittler in the same condition, there to be so returned. However, that does not impose an affirmative obligation to, say, rebuild a canopy after it's been removed because the underground storage tanks had to be removed.
So let me maybe it's unclear how things are set up, but the buildings themselves, the gas station building, were the pipes and everything that was just subject to remediation, were they right under the building? In other words, aren't those usually some distance away from the building?
The underground piping?
Yes.
Yes, I believe they were set back.
So letting the gas station where everybody operates and rings up the, so we can make sure we're on the same page, and the ceiling falls in and everything. That really has nothing to do with the pumps and the storage tanks underneath, because they're some distance away.
So
then what this whole issue that my colleagues have been focused on, this whole maintenance issue, so why wasn't there some obligation to maintain that? Because that's separate and apart from the pumps and the storage tanks and everything.
Your Honor, I believe the answer is that the Master Amendment expressly recognizes Marathon's ability to discontinue its operations. In fact, Marathon is necessarily discontinuing its operations at the building. And so as a consequence of that, some of the buildings fell into disrepair. As I said, though, that did not leave Bittler without a remedy. They have received approximately $269,000, which was consistent with the testimony at trial, to restore those properties. However, there were no specific lease up.
Breach of contract or for waste?
For waste. And we believe that we have not appealed that judgment, and we believe it would cover the breach of contract if there were any maintenance obligations in the contract as well. This is a contract without specific maintenance obligations that does authorize Marathon to discontinue its operations. And so as a consequence...
Well, are you arguing that they have gotten, in the name of waste, everything that they would have been entitled to under the contract? Is that the argument?
That's correct, Your Honor. They have really sought two categories of damages for breach of contract. One is the degradation of the property, and that we believe is covered by the waste damages. The second is for loss of use of the property. Those damages, however, we believe, and the district court agreed, were unavailable because Marathon paid rent consistent with the Master Amendment throughout its occupation and remediation of the property.
Okay, that gets us into the unreasonable delay question, right? And as I understand it, the district judge said just across the board, you don't have an expert saying this, giving me an opinion, this is unreasonable delay, so you lose, right?
That was one basis for the district court's holding.
What else was there?
The district court also pointed out that the lease contemplates the possibility of delay because it allows Marathon to remain on the premises after the underground storage tank removal, and the parties specifically protected their interest by providing for an amount of rent that Marathon would pay during the remediation
period. Would
that
be good for 100 years?
If the process took 100 years, yes.
And you think, well, what if nothing's happening for 100 years? Just Marathon is just paying the rent.
It's a more difficult question. But
do we need an expert to say that's unreasonable?
You may not need an expert to say it's unreasonable if nothing's done for 100 years.
Yeah.
But in this case, there was activity on the property, and there is a process of regulatory closure, none of which there was expert testimony
for. What about the citations for delay from the agencies?
Again, we believe an expert would be needed to provide to a lay juror the meaning of that citation.
Really? Okay. How about 20 years? That was Battle Creek. Reasonable to take 20 years to complete the remediation?
Given the work that had to be done and the regulatory challenges faced, we believe that was reasonable, yes.
And I understand you believe it was reasonable, but there's no room for reasonable disagreement about that question?
There may be, and had they presented expert testimony, then they might have created an issue of fact for the jury, but in fact, they didn't.
How about in North Manchester, 6 years of no active remediation? If nothing's going on, why isn't it reasonable to say that's too long? No expert needed.
Because there are a number of factors that may affect why nothing's going on. There may be some preliminary work that has to be done. Soil samples, you may have to get approval for the specific environmental remediation process used. There are a number of factors that are well outside the understanding of a lay juror for which expert testimony is appropriate and necessary in this case. And further, the parties agreed that Marathon could remain on the premises. See, I'm out of time.
Well,
let me ask you a question about the double damages. So you argue that because the statute talks about a lease for years, that they're not entitled to double damages?
That's correct.
Are they entitled to any waste remedy?
The jury found and awarded them actual damages on four of the properties in Michigan.
No, but I mean in the waste, if you don't have the lease for years, do you get single damages, or is waste limited to the situation where you have a lease for years or a life tenancy?
A tenant, even outside the requirements of Michigan Statute 600.2919, can obtain actual damages for waste, but the statutory doubler on those damages is limited to life tenant, tenant in dower, or tenant
isn't
for years.
Isn't this tenancy for years, isn't that a term of art not meant to be literal? Isn't it just require that the lease have a term? So it wouldn't make any sense otherwise, right? I mean, suppose you had a six-month lease, and in the course of it, the tenant goes crazy, goes wild, and destroys the property, right? And that certainly would be a case for double damages.
Not under the Michigan statute.
That's just a literal interpretation. Is there a history? Is there an interpretation that
the
gives meaning in Michigan or other states to a lease for years? See, one way to look at it is that the term that precedes it is life tenancy, right? So you say, well, you have life tenant, that's for life. But then you can have it a term. They could say term for years, meaning a fixed term, even though it's less than life. I mean, there's plenty of, opaque statutory draftsmanship. Now, I don't see what sense it would make to say that you have to have years rather than months.
Two responses to that. First, Michigan courts have distinguished between month-to-month tenancies and tenancies for years, and that's the Polite versus Michigan Taekwondo Association we cited in our brief that specifically noted that someone could be a month-to-month tenant rather than a tenant for years, even if the month-to-month tenancy ran past the period of a year. The question is just sort of like it is under the statute of frauds, is it necessarily a period of a year or longer? And second, the case that plaintiffs rely on, the NRA Macomb occupational health care case, requires to have a tenancy for years that there be a fixed and ascertainable duration to the lease. And we don't have that here.
I don't understand that, because obviously with a life tenancy, you don't have a fixed and ascertainable period. It depends on how long the person lives.
Correct. And that is the fixed and ascertainable requirement, at least according to the bankruptcy case plaintiff cited, is not imposed on a life tenancy.
Well, what's the sense of it? Give a reason why they would distinguish in this way between a life tenancy and a month-to-month or some other.
If I were to guess the reason the Michigan legislature would do this, it involves the amount of time that the property will be out of the landlord's control.
Life tenancy, right? The person could die tomorrow.
Correct.
The common law treats this as a term of art, tenant for years, as distinguished from tenant at will. There's case law saying it can be one day or 1,000 years, and it's still a tenancy for years for these kinds of purposes. Now, if that's the interpretation, then this certainly looks like a tenancy for years.
If that were how the Michigan courts had interpreted tenancy for years, I would agree that this is not a tenancy at will, for example. Mm-hmm. There's some event that has to occur before the parties can in the lease. However, in light of the cases we cited, we believe Michigan has recognized the difference between a month-to-month tenancy and a tenancy for years. And the language in this master amendment specifically calls it a month-to-month tenancy.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Craig. So,
thank
Mr.
Your
Emhart, your time has expired, but you can have a little more time.
My first point is that in listening to the back and forth on oral argument here, what we have is a contract that is becoming ambiguous because of the extended remediation that went on that was not contemplated by either side. And again, both sides, as of November 7 of 2000, agreed that all the terms going back and forth required that Marathon restore the buildings, and they simply wanted to delay that a little bit of time while they continued to do remediation or until we found new tenants.
But since you got waste damages, are you looking for anything except delay damages? Is that all that's left in the case?
And on the two sites, there are eight sites on appeal, six were tried. The two that weren't tried on the waste claims, both of those buildings were condemned by the local authorities in Michigan Center and Adrian, and then our clients signed consents to have them removed. So they lost all buildings at those other.
Those two are what?
Michigan Center and Adrian.
Michigan Center? I don't even have that.
The finding of the district court was that because the improvements had been.
What's it called? I'm just trying to.
Michigan Center.
Well, where's Michigan Center? You gave me a list.
That's the name of the town, right?
I think it is.
Okay. Yeah.
So what's the name of? I don't understand. You said Adria, something Creek, Coldwater,
Michigan Center, Wausau, Portland, Sturgis.
And then, where is this Michigan?
Michigan Center was the.
Does it have another name in this list?
No, I didn't give you Michigan Center before, I apologize. I meant to. On the double damages argument, I think it's important to look at how the tenant gets access to the property. And here it was through an 11-year lease with a 10-year extension term, and that's how they were there on the property utilizing it. And that's a fair way to look at is someone a tenant for years.
I'm trying to figure. I don't understand. You got the waste down. Forget the doubling. That's a different issue. But I'm talking about the compensatory damages. So you have breach of contract. You have waste damages, right? So what is it? What additional damages are you looking for? These delay damages or what?
The damages for not being able to have the properties, the delay damages over a long period of time.
That's what you want? Is that all that's left?
Plus the consent issues.
Oh, and the consent issues are in play at the Michigan Center and Adrian properties.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And
consent issues, what do you mean?
The district court decided that when my client signed consents to have buildings removed, that eliminated any claims they had for breach of contract or waste.
And both of those were after local authorities had issued condemnation orders, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
If you had not consented, what would have happened?
I guess the local authorities would have taken it to the next level.
They would have hired different contractors, charged you, and destroyed the buildings anyway, right?
I would say that's the likely result, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.
Thank you.
And